Thanks, Henry. And yeah, thank you very much for putting on such a fantastic series of speakers and events, and it's great to be here. This paper is a paper about worms. More specifically, it's about a group of helminths, so worm-like intestinal parasites that inhabit all vertebrate animals. Our ancestors evolved with helminths, and the majority of people in the world are still infected by them. However, they've become uncommon in the developed world. I'd hazard that there are probably a few helminths in the room today. Helminths are invertebrate animals. They come in many shapes and sizes. Some, like this, some, like this 60-foot tapeworm, a fish tapeworm, not a human tapeworm, so that's longer than this room, are clearly bigger than a mouse. The ones I'm talking about today is the human hookworm, Necator americanus, so one of two species of human hookworm, which in its adult phase is about the tenth of the size of a standard mouth. It's about a centimetre long. I want to start by talking a little bit about this animal's human parasitology. I'll then briefly trace historic and ongoing efforts to eradicate this nightmare of nature, to use the title from a children's collector's card. These efforts seek to address the pathological consequences of high worm loads, of having too many worms in your body. I then want to contrast these with recent enthusiasms for hookworm as a colon comrade. This is a screen grab from a blog of somebody who is using hookworm as a tool for biotherapy, or biome restoration, as it's called, to address the rapid increase in allergy and inflammatory and autoimmune diseases. So my analysis focuses on the seeming paradox of simultaneous, if not territorially contiguous, programs to deworm and reworm the world, in which the hookworm can be understood as both a nightmare of nature and as a colon comrade. I want to trace the emergence of a post-pasteurian, to use Heather Paxson, the anthropologist's terms, or probiotic art of living with hookworm, and contrast this with the still ascendant antibiotic mode of governing life, or of governing parasitic life. In so doing, I'll seek to explore what hookworm can tell us about the microbiogeographies of immunity that characterize contemporary human-animal relations. It's a very grand claim. Whether I'll do that or not, I'll leave it up to you. It's worth saying this emerges out of work that I've been doing on the macrobiome. I've been interested in efforts to reintroduce cows and other organisms to restore or rewild ecologies in the macrobiome. And I'm trying to take some of these ideas into the microbiome. And it's early days in this work. You'll notice that it's quite a broad brush picture I'm painting, but the intention is to get more involved in some of the specific empirical ethnographic multi-species relationships associated with human hookworm entanglements. Okay, so a little bit about helminths and their parasitology. Scientists have recorded over 300 species of helminth that parasitize humans. Many are rare or accidental, but there are about 90 common species. Frank Cox divides these into heirlooms and souvenirs. Heirlooms are parasites we inherited from our ancestors in Africa. Souvenirs are those we acquired from the animals with which we've come in contact during our evolution, subsequent migration, agricultural practices. Now, the hookworm is an heirloom species, so it's been in us for a long time. In practice, few helminths are host-specific. Many of our parasites are zoonotic, so we share them with other species. And polyparasitism, so having many different parasites, is a common phenomena. We evolved and still largely live in a wormy world, entangled in a range of multi-species gift economies. Helminths have three main life cycle stages, so eggs, larvae, and adults. These take radically different anatomical forms, at least as seen from a human perspective, but all of these are technically animal. There are four main modes of human four main modes of transmission by which helminths larvae infect animals, including humans, shown by the circular diagrams there. So fecal-oral, like pinworms, which is still the most prevalent helminth in much of the Western world. Transdermal, which is I'll talk about, which is the case with the human hookworm. Vector-borne, so parasites spread by mosquitoes or by snails, for example. Or predator-prey transmission. So this is a grain beetle eaten by rats, but also, until quite recently, common in grain that we would eat and make bread with, and parasites. We would, you know, be eating grain beetles and getting grain beetle tapeworms, particularly rat tapeworms that pass through grain beetles into us historically. So different mechanisms through which we are entangled into these ecologies with other forms of life. The human hookworm is transmitted transdermally, so through the skin. A little bit about the life cycle. So humans acquire hookworm when the infective larval stage living in the soil penetrates through the skin, generally through the bare foot. These larvae are developmentally arrested at this point, a bit like I would hazard Jacob's ticks, which we might hear about in a second, and they live in the earth for several weeks. After entering the host, the larvae resume development, migrating up through the blood vessels to the right-hand side of the heart, and then they eat their way out into the lung. From here, they're coughed up into the throat and swallowed. They enter the intestines where they molt twice and develop into their adult stage. They feed on the blood from the walls of the intestine. 5 to 8 weeks pass from the time that they first infect humans until they reach sexual maturity and mate. Each female hookworm produces thousands of eggs daily. They can live in the intestine for an average of 3 to 10 years. Maximum lifespan recorded is 18 years. Hookworm eggs exit the body in our feces. When deposited in the soil with adequate warmth, shade, and moisture, the eggs hatch within 24 to 48 hours, giving rise to new larvae, and so the cycle would continue. So other forms of life in us, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, fungi, helminths do not proliferate on their own within the human body. They need to leave the body to complete their life cycle. Populations therefore tend to develop relatively slowly, and their presence is often without symptoms. Recent research suggests that hookworm can enter into symbiotic relationships with their host. After an initial, generally unsuccessful effort to shift the worms, the body learns to tolerate a bearable worm load. People do not tend to develop immunity, if we take that as the absence of non-self matter, and I'll come on to different concepts of immunity, but if we take it as that, you know, prevalent understanding of immunity. Instead, worms trigger an immune suppressant response, enabling their persistence within the body. Human bodies learn to be affected by worms, calibrating immune systems through an ongoing molecular exchange. So the story goes. But populations of hookworm accumulate over the life course. They can have pathological effects on people with poor nutrition, high levels of exposure, or particular genetic dispositions. It's quite unknown to a certain extent why it is that hookworm disease, which is differentiated from hookworm infection, comes into being. But it is it's a major public health problem. Hookworm disease leads to protein deficiency, anemia, as well as affecting cognitive function, for example, learning and development in schools. During the latter half of the 19th century, hookworm was known as the germ of laziness due to its effects upon the productivity of largely colonial plantation workers. So as a consequence, hookworm has been and continue to be the subject of major international public health campaigns. At the start of the 20th century, the Rockefeller Foundation launched its first sanitary commission to tackle hookworm in the south of the USA. This is sort of 1910 or so. The success of this project catalyzed the Rockefeller International Health Division, which morphed after World War II into what is now the WHO, into the World Health Organization. So the WHO, in many ways, has its roots in hookworm. It's a kind of wormy history of the WHO. After some initial success in the US, in Europe and Australia, interest in hookworm plateaued. Hookworm disease is currently classified as a neglected tropical disease, neglect largely assessed in relation to malaria, HIV and TB. But in September 2006, Bill Clinton launched the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Diseases. And this initiative has received significant funding from the Gates Foundation, who currently fund an ambitious program to deworm the world. Okay. Anti-worm drugs are readily available, but they're of limited efficacy when infectious larvae remain in the soil. Successful hookworm eradication therefore focuses on improvements in hygiene and sanitation practices, particularly wearing shoes, providing decent toilets, and not using feces as fertilizer. Such socialized medicine is of course difficult, and instead efforts are currently underway to develop a hookworm vaccine. So far with limited success, it appears difficult to vaccinate against something to which we do not become immune after infection. But there's a lot of money being spent on trying to develop a vaccine. Today, about 700 million people are infected with human hookworm, primarily in disadvantaged communities in tropical and subtropical regions. 200 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, 200 million people in China. Significant decreases in Asia and Latin America due to control efforts. Levels in sub-Saharan Africa have remained fairly consistent over the last 50 years. According to the metrics that are used to calculate these things, hookworm have a global disease burden of 1.5 to 22.1 million disability-adjusted life years. If that means anything, we can disentangle that. It's clearly a lot, you know, of you know, social impacts caused by hookworm. The eradication of hookworms in the north is generally taken as a success story. This is evidence of the power of modern antibiotic science. In the grand narrative of the moderns, made famous in Latour's account of pasteurization, science coupled to medicine, engineering, and governance enables the domestication of nature, the elimination of risks, and the securitization of the human. This is development writ large through philanthropy and public-private collaboration. But this triumphalist narrative has begun to be questioned by a growing body of scientific theory, evidence, and vernacular practice. Epidemiologists have noted the increase in geographic incidence of what have become known as diseases of affluence, non-communicative conditions like allergy, obesity, and a host of inflammatory conditions that map quite closely onto areas from which hookworm and other parasites have been eradicated. So this is a slide that often circulates in presentations around what's come to be known as the hygiene hypothesis, which lays out a set of what they consider to be epidemiological evidence to explore how the absence of hookworm might be associated with the rise of these conditions. In 1989, David Strachan offered the hygiene hypothesis to account for these patterns, suggesting that the triumph of modern medicine and hygiene risk becoming pathological. So many of the things that are celebrated in this account of being modern have in some ways been reinterpreted as vectors through which we might become, you know, more ill, let's say. The hypothesis has been refined in recent years into the old friends hypothesis, so a sense the absence of old friends might be leading to these conditions, or even the biodiversity hypothesis, that the lack of exposure to a diversity of life is causing these conditions. The key thing here is it's the absence of certain microbial organisms and ecologies with which we evolved, unsettling basic bodily systems that enable metabolism and immunity. In becoming modern, the superorganism, the human superorganism, is in danger of unraveling. They're also tracking interesting comparable developments in our companion animals. So maybe the sheep that we heard about previously, certainly dogs and cats that have been subject to many of the same treatments of us, are also developing comparable allergic conditions. This thinking has informed a collection of scientific and other experiments using helminths as forms of biotherapy or biome restoration. What we get next. This is a screen grab of one of the organizations. Generally affluent, urban, well-educated patients in the global north have become taking worms to tackle a range of allergies and autoimmune conditions. Perhaps most frequently Crohn's disease, but a range of other allergies like hay fever have been subject to these forms of experiments. In hosting their worms, people are learning to nurture and monitor the animal's health, blogging about their sometimes salutary experiences with their colon comrades or gut buddies. Some people have learned to grow their own, harvesting new stock from their own feces and supplying others through various economic arrangements. We can understand these developments in context of a wider set of enthusiasms for probiotic approaches to health, including various forms of bacteria therapy. You've probably heard about fecal transplants, this idea of, you know, moving poo around. To a certain extent, I think what Steph is talking about with the good bugs out there in the microbiome, you could maybe connect up to this story in some way. One of the early advocates for this helminth therapy was a man called Jasper Lawrence, shown here, a British-born West Coast US entrepreneur. Inspired by the hygiene hypothesis, Jasper took himself off to rural Cameroon in the early 2000s to walk in some latrines in the hope of picking up hookworm to cure his hay fever. Kind of return to the source type idea. He got the wrong worm, but after a further trip to Belize, he established his own breeding colony. He now works with a doctor in Mexico, or at least until recently he did, and has started his own company called Autoimmune Therapies, breeding, selling, and infecting his worms into visiting customers. Interest in the therapy has mushroomed since. There is an online hookworm underground, to use the science writer Moises Velasquez-Manoff's terms. He has a great book which touches on this story. There are retailers, support groups, advocates, enthusiasts sharing knowledge, technologies, and organisms. Various scientists are becoming interested. Clinical trials are afoot. Phase one trials are complete to demonstrate that it's safe to take hookworm. Phase two trials to date are largely inconclusive. One company called Coronado Biosciences has trademarked a pig whipworm ova, so the eggs of a pig whipworm that you can take into humans. They have a patent out on this organism, and they're in search of other patentable products. Meanwhile, regulatory authorities like the FDA are alarmed about the potential resurgence of this pest. It's currently illegal to bring hookworm into the USA or to ship it around within the USA, outside of the human body or to distribute it. But it's perfectly possible to nip across the border to Tijuana to get infected and come back across. So Jesper Lawrence runs his outfit in Tijuana, and you go across, you get infected, you come back across the border again. Perhaps the most articulate group within this emerging biotherapy economy are affiliated to an organization called Biome Restoration. So this group that I was mentioning previously. They borrow heavily on the writings of a doctor called William Parker, who's a surgeon at Duke University, who coined the concept from which the organization takes its name. The director of Biome Restoration is a radiologist called Don Donahue, who spent some time systematically reviewing the parasitology literature to identify what for him would be the ideal human symbiont. And they use the term symbiont on the website. He settled on HDC. I won't try pronouncing it, but that's the name of the organism down there, which is the larval stage of a rat tapeworm commonly found in grain beetles. So that's the grain beetle that I was making reference to previously. Grain beetles are readily available. The larvae are readily available. They're often used for kind of high school biology experiments. You can buy them online. They used to be common in the human food supply, and they don't take up residence in the human body. So unlike the hookworm, they sort of pass through gradually, and you poo them out. They're gone in a couple of weeks. So of course you have to go back and buy them every couple of weeks rather than getting hold of the organism. The organization's website presents this as a probiotic food supplement. So they want to get regulated as a food product rather than as a health product, because it's a different jurisdiction, which should be taken as part of a healthy diet, not as a specific therapy. Their mission is to reworm the world. They talk about it in these terms. So in this post-pasteurian microbiopolitics, and it's a terminology that Heather Paxson's developing to talk about raw food, but I think we can think about it in the context of these bugs as well. Hygiene is understood to have gone too far. Our desire for order and disconnection has become pathological. For some, we need to return to a dirtier, messier past through a fairly gung-ho embrace of the pre-modern microbiome. So Michael Polliner's got interested in this. He had a piece in the New York Times magazine. It's fairly nuanced, but he's quite enthralled to a guy called Jeff Leach, who runs the Human Food Project. And Jeff Leach has recently undergone a fecal transplant with the entire contents of the lower intestine of a Hadza hunter-gatherer from Tanzania. And there's a kind of fairly heroic, masculine, you know, let's go out and expose ourselves to this sort of primitive microbiome as a way of getting in touch with nature. So there's that manifestation of it, which I think is problematic in many, many ways. For others, we need to rework our science and technology to domesticate our parasites, or synthesizing their secretions to selectively and strategically intervene into complex systems. Okay, so that's the story to an extent. How am I doing for time, Henry? How much have I got for?
You've got about 5 minutes.
Ten or five.
Cut me.
Okay, so that's the story, the kind of the deworming and the reworming. So there's this, for me, quite interesting but deeply paradoxical situation in which two groups of scientists, healthcare practitioners, and patients are seeking to simultaneously deworm and reworm the world. The groups are largely discrete, so there is some conversation between the two of them, particularly those who are studying populations that get dewormed to look at the subsequent manifestation of allergies. So there is some traffic, but they seem to be operating in somewhat different worlds. So what can we in animal studies take from this story? three obvious, familiar, but nonetheless incredibly important points to begin with. So there's clearly uneven colonial neoliberal geographies and political ecologies at work in the spacings of these animals. The global biogeography of hookworm is strongly shaped by human histories of development, modernization, slavery, abandonment. You can read that into the kind of phylogeography of where these organisms came from. Hookworm was initially a plantation labour productivity problem for modern medicine. Underfunded efforts to deworm the bottom billion through pills are ineffectual due to the absence of the types of sanitation that we take for granted. Such endeavours offer easy public relations for big pharmaceutical companies distributing out-of-patent drugs. So these drugs have been around for a while, the profit margins are very slim. The efficacy of these drugs is declining. The only current source of new anti-helminth drugs is the agriculture and veterinary industries. So many new drugs only come on stream because we need better drugs for cows or better drugs for dogs rather than better drugs for people. That's where the money is in helminths. Meanwhile, the return of the hookworm comes about through a range of different political ecologies. We've got Jasper Lawrence's kind of bioprospecting return to the source to this privatized human whipworm with Coronado Biosciences. They've decoded the genome of the human hookworm, and it's described in the paper in Nature as this veritable pharmacopoeia, or pharmacopedia. You know, there's this sort of suddenly all these molecules will become available, particularly to get sort of privatized synthetic versions of the anti-inflammatory things that hookworms secrete them. So it's a huge market for those types of products out there. The flip side being this kind of hookworm underground, who are very keen on spreading these worms and this information through a much more kind of communitarian logic of you know, how the worms should be spread. They keep offering to send me these damn things. You know, you've got to have some of these worms, we'll give them to you for free. You know, this is, you know, they're sort of somewhat kind of messianic about the you know, the virtues of these worms. Second, we can see further confirmation of the partialities in non-human concern for animal life. You know, so clearly these worms don't get a lot of traffic in conservation circles. There isn't a kind of Rachel Carson for helminths, and yet there's been a, you know, fairly massive eradication of helminths in animals and in us by virtue of these anti-helminth drugs. They don't feature prominently in, you know, conservation concern. Third, we can take the recent reappraisal of the role of helminths as part of a wider interest in the abundance and significance of the human microbiome. Human microbiome work tends to be primarily concerned with bacteria, but if we should kind of expand that a bit, you know, we could probably include helminths within that story. This has been made possible by technologies of metagenomics, which enable us to kind of sequence bacteria that previously weren't visible through technologies where you had to culture them. Ecological evolutionary biologists like Scott Gilbert argue that a paradigm shift would seem to be underway in contemporary biology, away from the modern synthesis, so the combination of Darwin plus Mendelian genetics, and its focus on genetic individuals. We're learning that a lot of us is not us, in any simple sense of being human, and that the shifting dynamics of the animal and the bacterial non-us in us has important consequences for human and environmental health. So Haraway writes about this, you know, we've never been human. We've co-evolved with our parasites, our symbionts, and our gut buddies. We're entangled with them, and with and without them, the human superorganism risks unraveling. So the story goes. But of course, the modern figure of the human doesn't appear to be disappearing anytime soon. You know, this is the era of the Anthropocene. This is the era of the, you know, heroic, singular species figure. With good reasons, the biopolitics of human-helminth relations remains fixed on securing certain human life in individual and aggregate forms, often at the expense of certain human and non-human commensals. What is perhaps most interesting about the story of the re and deworming is it offers us a chance to look at the emergence of this kind of probiotic form of biopolitics, this kind of strategic way of reintroducing forms of life to work on life. I want to try and reclaim the term probiotic from the health food industry, who sort of harnessed onto this, for whom it's a very much a kind of silver bullet, single organism cure for some specific ailment. And to think about probiotic arts of living, which take up this kind of post-Pasteurian ethos that Heather Paxson is talking about. So these move off from an antibiotic model of immunity premised on the separation of self and other, to flag the salutary properties of infection, parasitism, and multi-species community. Scott Gilbert, who's an ecological evolutionary biologist, has a nice paper in which he talks about the shifting metaphors in which we're thinking about human non-human relationships on this scale, from war through tolerance to active recruitment, a sense that organisms work to actively recruit particular non-humans to maintain systemic properties. So the subject of this recruitment is not an intentional human mind, it's a superorganism working in collaboration with its microbial constituents. As with the recruitment of wolves and cows for rewilding the macrobiome, this process is not done laissez-faire. Instead, it's a biopolitics targeted towards specific systemic properties, functions and processes emergent from human ecologies whose values include resilience, complexity, mess, functional redundancy. These are the kind of terms of a given status. It's a very different ontology. People have talked about it in terms of the Baroque. Conscious that Gale has used that term, in stark contrast to the kind of modernist dreams of 20th century social and medical hygienists, which is about separation and purity. The microbiogeographies, or the animal, bacterial, fungal, viral places that ought to underpin a probiotic approach to the human microbiome are not well understood. This is early days in this science. They're currently the subject of a range of really interesting research projects. But it's clear that the binary territorializations that pathologize life in us as germs don't work. Instead, they can in themselves be deadly. Absences can be as troubling as presences in this story. While certain presences are vital for systemic function. So Steve Hinchcliffe and others in their work on biosecurity have offered this much more kind of topological imagination of biogeography, in which life is folded together and we need to think about entanglements that cut across species boundaries. Recent work on the microbiome is beginning to specify the geographies that shape where an organism becomes a symbiont and when it becomes a pathobiont. So this is a new term, which is a kind of, it's very much about matter out of place. A microorganism that can be part of the normal microbiota in healthy hosts, but that can cause disease when some aspect of the host microbial system is disrupted. So hookworm, in some ways, can be both. They can be symbionts and they can be pathobionts, and there's a very interesting geography as to when and where that occurs. Okay. I think I'll leave it there for now in terms of how we're making sense of it. Yeah.
Thanks, Jamie. So, I hope we didn't rush you at the end.
No.
Good. Let's have some questions, did you? Please.
Sorry, am I the only question?